KPCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour here on KPCW. So yesterday was a picture-perfect day here in Park City. On the phone is Cedric Haynes. Hopefully he's going to give us another one. What are we looking at, Cedric?
I think we are going to be in luck, guys. Yeah, we've got some nice weather coming our way. Lots of sunshine is expected again for us this afternoon. We're looking at highs getting a little toasty, but not bad considering the heat wave we had. We'll be looking at highs looking like around Park City will climb into the low to mid 80s, but we will get probably upper 80s and low 90s in the Heber Valley. So a lot of sunshine. Make sure that you have that sunscreen SPF 30 or greater. You could burn in less than 15 minutes. And of course, you know, a lot of folks are probably wondering about this evening's weather. Of course, we know that we've got some high school football kicking off in some spots, and Park City, of course, has a big game there in Heber, and it's looking pretty good at around 7 o'clock or so. Temperatures will be around 90 degrees, falling into the 80s throughout the game, so it will be a warm one, so hopefully everyone's staying hydrated throughout the day so that when we get to Friday evening, the weather won't be too much of a shot for them, but it will be dry, so it looks like we're not going to be looking at any delays or cancellations in any of those games in terms of the weather. Now, as we go into the weekend, and that will change as we are expecting a big pattern change with that monsoon moisture returning across the area. That's going to give us a good chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms both Saturday and Sunday. Now, it will not be a washout, meaning it rains all day both Saturday and Sunday, but there will definitely be periods where we will see some passing showers and storms, and they're going to produce some heavy rainfall, some frequent lightning, and that potential of some isolated flash flooding. So if you are going to be doing any recreating or just going to be out and about throughout the weekend, make sure that you've got a couple of ways to receive some weather information, because those pop-up storms will obviously pop up quickly in the afternoon, and they could pack a punch. So that is something that we're going to be watching for you very closely. Again, not a washout, but there is a good chance of those scattered showers and storms both Saturday and Sunday afternoon. So have a plan B just in case if you have any outdoor events to move those inside, as we will be looking at that pretty good chance of rain. Now, that off and on monsoon pattern will stick around as we go into the beginning of next week, with good chances of showers and storms on Monday and Tuesday as well. And this will actually help keep temperatures down a little cooler than typical. We'll be looking at highs mainly in the low 80s around Park City and up 80s to around 90 as you get off towards the Heber Valley. But either way, it is going to be an unsettled pattern starting on Saturday, going throughout about Tuesday of next week at least. But the good news is, to wrap up our week after a wild and wacky severe weather start, we're going to be ending things on a good note with lots of sunshine today, but just a bit on the toasty side. But again, make sure you keep an eye to the skies as we go into the weekend, as we are going to be tracking that chance of showers and storms. And a few of those storms could be severe, with that lightning and that gusty winds and that threat of heavy rainfall, which will be a big problem, not just for Heber Valley over towards Park City, but really for the entire state. But of course, we'll keep you updated throughout the weekend, but enjoy your Friday afternoon.
Cedric, are these the kinds of storms that could also give us some hail?
Yes, they could. And basically, these storms, they build up quickly, and you see those clouds building up in the afternoon. Those show us that we have a lot of what we call strong updrafts, and that means that there's a lot of instability to create those hailstones. And once the storm collapses, that's when the hail drops down. So keep that in mind.
All right, Cedric, thanks, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you so much.
KPCW News. Time is 8:10. As Cedric mentioned, high school football does start tonight. We will be broadcasting the Park City High School football game live here on KPCW. And if you're not feeling like listening to football, we want to remind you that the KPCW Cole Sport Back Alley Bash will be going on. It starts at 5 o'clock, so you can actually come and join us at City Park for a couple hours and then catch the football game. The concerts kick off at 5 with Bad Francis, followed by Mud Puddle at 7. Activities for kiddos like face painting and balloon twisting will be available throughout the event. We hope you can join us. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, we'll hear an interview Parker Malatesta did, recorded with Zach Padmore. Then Jeremy Rubel will join us with an update from yesterday's Park City Council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by chatting with Sarah Irvin, KPCW's Director of Development. We now have a pre-recorded interview that KPCW reporter Parker Malatesta did with Zach Padmore, author of the new book, Life After Deadpool, which focuses on the decline of Lake Powell in southern Utah.
I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Today on the phone with me, I've got Zach Padmore. He's the former Southern Utah reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of the new book, Life After Deadpool, which covers the decline of Lake Powell and the gradual reawakening of Glen Canyon. How are you doing today, Zach?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, Parker.
You know, so I guess to start, we'll you know, what, you know, you did a lot of reporting down there, and I'm sure covering Glen Canyon and Lake Powell. You know, why did you decide you wanted to write a book, and what was kind of the message you were going for going into it?
Yeah, I got involved in this project in 2021 when I did a trip with the Returning Rapids Project, a group in Moab that's facilitating science in the former bed of Lake Powell and along the recovering rapids of Cataract Canyon. We spent a week floating down the river into, you know, past the high water mark of Lake Powell and into the recovery zone. There were 20 some scientists on the trip, and so doing some research, or, you know, reporting on some research out there with those scientists, and also hearing stories from the other efforts that are underway on Greater Glen Canyon to get a grasp on how the landscape is changing with record low waters inspired me to turn an article I wrote for the Salt Lake Tribune on that trip into this book, which is coming out on August 27th. It was just so inspiring to see how the landscape has changed since Lake Powell was last full in 1999. It's a really hopeful story of ecological recovery along a lot of the side canyons that feed into Glen Canyon. And it inspired me to go out there a lot and see those changes with different experts and to try to share that story with others.
Yeah, and if we can, you know, rewind back to the 1960s, can you kind of give us a brief history lesson on how Lake Powell came to be?
Yeah, the Glen Canyon Dam, which forms Lake Powell, was authorized in the 1950s. It was the last major dam project built by the Bureau of Reclamation and the tail end of a huge dam building spree that had built a lot of hydroelectric dams and reservoirs across the western U.S. And the kind of the history of what was lost as Lake Powell started to fill in the 1960s is a pretty well-known one. There were battles between the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, Floyd Dominey, and people like David Brower of the Sierra Club that led to a movement to prevent other dams from being built. There were five dams proposed in the Grand Canyon right after the Glen Canyon Dam was completed. Those were defeated in large part over environmental outrage around the loss of Glen Canyon, which people, you know, realized, you know, at least people in the environmental community who weren't from Utah or from Arizona, realized was a national park quality landscape after it was too late. Of course, people who were from the region and indigenous people who considered Glen Canyon home for thousands of years knew what was there, but people like David Brower from California came to that battle a little too late, and they decided that they were going to go all out in defeating other large dam projects that would have similar consequences like those in the Grand Canyon. So it's a pretty pivotal piece of the history of the environmental movement in the Southwest. But what I tried to do in this book was to take us into the present more and not tell that story as much as the story of what's happened there over the last 24 years.
Yeah, and as you say, some, you know, Glen Canyon slowly reemerging as the water has declined in recent years. What were some of the journeys you went on to write this book to kind of investigate that?
I did a couple long kayak trips across Lake Powell, stopping in different side canyons, hiking up them. A lot of the side canyons, even though it's, you know, a really dry part of the country in southern Utah, have year-round flowing streams in them, and if you pretty much pick any of the side canyons and start hiking up them, you'll see the different stages of recovery that are occurring there as you go upstream. You'll start in places that have maybe only been out for a few weeks or a few months if the lake is actively dropping. And then you enter elevations that have been out for 3 or 5 years, and you'll see, you know, willows starting to reestablish and more aquatic life in the pools, toads and frogs and fish. And then you get further up and you'll see 50, 60 foot cottonwood trees that might have, you know, beer cans from the 1970s around their base when Lake Powell was full, or, you know, sunken speedboats in places. So it's a surreal landscape of seeing this really healthy ecological recovery that's happening in the side canyons. Native species are winning out in the battle over how those canyons are being reestablished with ecologically speaking. And you also, you know, get a sense for just how much of Lake Powell has turned back into canyons as opposed to a reservoir since 1999. I wrote most of the book when the reservoir was repeatedly breaking its record low levels, and you know the reservoir's come up a little bit since then with the big runoff year we had in 2023 and the decent year we had this year, but there's still a lot of canyons that you know haven't been re-inundated. Lake Powell's around 40% full at its high point this summer. It was around 20% full when I was finishing the book finishing the reporting for the book in early 2023. So it's definitely not refilled yet, and we'd still need a lot of really great snow years to get back to where we were in 1999.
Yeah, and if we could go into that a little bit more, I mean, like, you know, like, as you said, you know, we've had two great winters. The beautiful boaters are out. but, you know, what do the trends tell us about what to expect going forward?
Well, the leading climate models show a overall decline in runoff in the Colorado River Basin. That's what we've seen since the Millennium Drought, as it's called, began in 2000. We've seen around a 20% on average reduction in flows compared to the previous century. Meanwhile, water demand throughout the Colorado River Basin, the around 40 million people who rely on water from the Colorado River, including along the Wasatch Front, has remained steady. So demand is steady and overall flows have declined, which is why Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the two largest reservoirs in the country, have gotten so low. So I think even though, you know, it doesn't contradict that overall trend to have a couple of good snow years. We had that in the runoff in 2011 as well. But if we have a couple more really bad years, like we've seen multiple winter seasons since 2000, we'd be right back to where we were on Lake Powell, which was, you know, right at the precipice of a real crisis for the Colorado River Basin because of the design of the Glen Canyon Dam, which we can get into if you want.
Yeah, could you just speak a little more on that?
Yeah, so in before the runoff started in 2023, we were very close to losing hydropower, the capacity to generate hydropower from the Glen Canyon Dam. There is only about 30 feet of buffer in the elevation of Lake Powell to the point where hydropower generation would have to stop. Lake Powell is still backing up 120 or so miles into the Colorado River, so it's still a large reservoir, but a lot of the boat ramps were unusable. And if we had had a bad runoff in 2023 instead of a great one, we very well could have seen that point. Mm-hmm. And if we had hit that point where hydropower stops on the Glen Canyon Dam, there isn't really an easy way to get all that water that's trapped in Lake Powell at that point around or through the dam and downstream to Lake Mead. There's only one set of lower outlets on the dam called the River Outlet Works. That's what's often called the Deadpool level on Lake Powell. They're still hundreds of feet above the historic elevation of the river. And those outlets aren't designed for continuous long-term use. In fact, they were just used for 3 days in 2023, and they were damaged in just those 3 days as part of a high flow experiment in the Grand Canyon. So we were getting very dangerously close to a situation where hydropower would stop and the releases from the Glen Canyon Dam into the Grand Canyon that feed Lake Mead and the 27 million people who get Colorado River water downstream from the Glen Canyon Dam could have been impacted very directly. It's you know, hard to say exactly how that would have played out, but there could have been huge mandated cuts to water use across the Colorado River Basin. That was something that was being discussed in 2022, and a lot of people would have felt that impact. And that's in large part due to the design of the Glen Canyon Dam. If there were a way to release water when the reservoir was very low, that crisis wouldn't have happened exactly when it did. We would have had more of a buffer to make decisions around water management and be able to use the 5 million acre feet, which is a lot of water that would be trapped in Lake Powell at that minimum power pool level. So that's a problem that hasn't been addressed yet. You know, we haven't changed the design of the Glen Canyon Dam, even though the Bureau of Reclamation started studying that publicly for the first time in 2022. So that's something that's potentially still on the table, but I'm afraid that if we don't take action now to seriously consider modifying the Glen Canyon Dam to allow releases in very severe drought conditions, we could be faced with a situation that's much worse than the one we'd have if we did have lower outlets on the dam.
Yeah, and if the power in the dam goes out, you know, what are the direct impacts from that?
The power generation has already been impacted by the low levels in Lake Powell that we've seen. So the output has already been reduced. There's only one study, as far as I know, that looks at what would happen if power generation stopped entirely from the Glen Canyon Dam. It's a 2015 study from the Glen Canyon Institute. And it basically concludes that most people wouldn't even notice if power generation stopped at the dam. 7 million people, I think, or millions of people across seven states get a small fraction of their power from the Glen Canyon Dam, but rates might change by, you know, 10 cents for most of those users over a year if power generation were to stop there. The Navajo Generating Station, which was located outside of Page, really close to the Glen Canyon Dam, a coal-fired power plant, shut down in 2019. It produced a lot more power than the Glen Canyon Dam, and you know, it hasn't led to any rolling blackouts across the Southwest or anything because of that. So it's definitely a source of lower carbon power and an important part of the Southwestern grid, but I don't think the power from the dam is as important as the water in the Colorado River, which cities from Las Vegas and Phoenix and Los Angeles and Denver and Salt Lake all rely on to get water to people in those cities. Also a lot of agriculture, of course, the main user of water in the Colorado River Basin. So I think that's the, most water managers agree that I think that is the most important use of Lake Powell is for water storage as opposed to power generation. And we are, with climate change and the drought we've had since 2000 is becoming less and less of a, Lake Powell is becoming less and less of an asset to that goal of meeting water delivery needs throughout the basin, because the dam is or was very close to turning into a barrier that prevents water releases, as opposed to a reservoir that stores water from wet years and allows it to be released in dry years.
Yeah, and generally this story has just had a negative connotation, especially 2 years ago when, Lake Powell and Lake Mead were both at very low levels. But you said earlier, you kind of view this book as a hopeful story. Why is that?
Yeah, that's what inspired me, I think, to spend so much time working on this topic, was because I've been an environmental journalist for over 10 years, and a lot of the stories we tell in that field are pretty depressing. Water, air contamination, everything that people are familiar with, climate change. But in a strange way, the story of what was happening and what is happening in Glen Canyon was a positive climate change story if you look at it from a certain angle, mm-hmm. because Lake Powell got so low because of climate change and overuse of water in the Colorado River Basin. But the consequence of that was that a lot of Glen Canyon, this magnificent place that people mourned the loss of in the 1960s and 70s, started to reemerge. There's slot canyons that have come out of the water that you can't tell were drowned by the reservoir for decades. There are the ecological recovery I was mentioning earlier that's been really promising. You know, ecologists have been surprised by the rate of the recovery and also the dominance of native species in a lot of these side canyons. There's rapids that are coming back in Cataract Canyon. There's miles and miles of river on the San Juan that used to be under the reservoir that are now in beautiful canyons. 40-some miles of river. So when I was growing up, I was running rivers around the Southwest with my family, and I thought I would never see Glen Canyon, but I've seen quite a bit of it and a lot of it as a river canyon over the course of writing this book. And nobody planned for this. There's been no efforts to, you know, manage the ecological recovery in the side canyon. It's all happened completely on its own. And that brings me a lot of hope that if we just give these places a chance to recover, they will be able to do so on their own without a ton of investment from land managers. The ecosystems come back.
Well, lastly, I did want to ask, you know, it was in the news last week about the collapse of the double arch in Glen Canyon. What can you tell us about this natural phenomenon and what do you make of it collapsing?
Yeah, it was a really cool spot. I just stumbled across it as I was paddling my kayak across Lake Powell a few years ago. I wasn't familiar with, you know, all the many wonders that are scattered across Lake Powell in Glen Canyon. And it was really cool to see that. Just as I was paddling along, I stopped and ate lunch there with my friend. And it was a really amazing spot. It almost certainly wouldn't have collapsed as soon as it did if it weren't for Lake Powell. If Glen Canyon Dam had never been built, there wouldn't have been, the arch wouldn't have been inundated, which weakens the sandstone. And then as water levels have fluctuated, you know, when the arch is at the reservoir level, wakes from passing boats slam into that arch and weaken it further. So I think for, you know, people who would like to see the Glen Canyon Dam modified and the river to return throughout Glen Canyon, the sooner that happens, the less of these impacts we'll see. Of course, there's going to be damage like this done to natural features just by nature of the fact that it has been a reservoir for so long. But if places are allowed to recover and be continuously out of the water, that will, I think, generally be better for protecting these resources as opposed to drowning them and revealing them again.
Yeah. Well, Zach, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Zach Podmore. He's the former Southern Utah reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of the new book, Life After Deadpool, which comes out August 27th.
As soon as next summer, part of the Monument of the Americas Sculpture Garden will open to the public. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more about the man behind the vision.
Sculptor Steve Neal says he moved to Heber after retiring from his career as a plastic surgeon, specifically so he could realize his vision of the sculpture garden. He believes the inspiration for the art came from God.
Well, it was more than just a passing thing. It was a very strong image in my mind. This is what you needed to do. This is a worthy project to do.
In fidelity to that vision, he's been hard at work for 29 years and, quote, tens of thousands of hours, crafting models, painstakingly molding tiny plaster faces, and fundraising to make the entire sculpture garden a reality. His home in Red Ledges, a gated community east of Heber, is full to the brim with Neal's paintings and sculptures. The sculpture garden is an expensive project. Neal says over $1 million have already gone towards casting sculptures in bronze, with another couple $1 million worth of bronze to go. He says the project is intended in part to exalt the country's founding.
Lots of our young people feel like they're being taught that the founding of America was flawed. and certainly in the scripture in the Book of Mormon, it says it was inspired of God.
As part of his teachings, Joseph Smith, the founder of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, preached that the U.S. Constitution was divinely inspired by God. Neil says he hopes visitors, whether members of the church or not, find spiritual inspiration in the sculpture garden too.
I think people will go who are not religious because they're curious, and I think they'll feel something.
The sculptures will be situated on 10 acres atop a hill near Utah Valley University's Wasatch campus, including a towering 18-foot statue of Jesus that Neil thinks most Heber and Midway residents will be able to see.
It'll be able to be seen by most of the valley.
The park will open in phases. The first sculptures will be placed on the land next summer. 21 of the sculptures are complete. Neil predicts all 71 will be finished in 2028. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Last night, the Park City Council held its regular meeting. A theme last night was, we're moving fast. And I want to talk to Jeremy a little bit about what he means by that, particularly when we start by talking about the Bonanza Park District, which has been there for a while. Jeremy, you said you're moving fast. What do you mean?
Yeah, good morning, Roger. We are moving fast. And, you know, previously it's been quite deliberate, right? There's been a number of iterations. We've done a lot of community outreach and engagement to gather the feedback out there, to hear what people want, what good looks like, and paint that picture. Now that we have that picture, you know, we've talked about narrowing the funnel as we move through the process, and we're at that stage where we're ready to narrow it again. So we have this RSOQ, which is a procurement document out on the street, and in plain language what that is saying, hey, development community and architects and everyone else out there, who would like to work with us on this amazing opportunity to build a great community gathering place right in the middle of Park City, Utah? And it sounds like we're going to have a lot of folks responding to that RSOQ. We haven't seen the responses quite yet. There's a selection committee that'll be reviewing them, and that'll be coming in the near future. And the next step after that will be going to an RFP, which is, again, narrowing that funnel further, where we say, okay, out of this pool of everyone who said who wants to work with us, who are we going to pick to work with us? Right, and then moving it forward from there, and they go through the planning and application process. So it's all really exciting.
So again, mechanically, you're going to award a contract to someone. What will that contract entail? Are they going to be, who's going to pay for the development? How's it going to work as a functional matter?
A lot of that is to be determined.
Okay.
We've had some discussions at the council right before we went on break last month around what's our tolerance, right? What are we looking for? Some of these big guiding principles, again, back to narrowing that funnel, right? Let's put some stakes in the ground. So we want community open green space, right? We want people to be able to gather. We don't want a super dense development with buildings stacked on top of each other. We want to preserve that zone we call the frontage protection zone, right? So that buildings aren't right on top of the busy streets, and when people arrive in town, they have a great arrival experience. Some of these really key elements of it, building height was another one we talked about a lot, incorporating affordable housing, that's out there in these requests, right? So what we're saying is, here's what we want to accomplish. We know that it might not be commercially viable just as it stands alone, and there might need to be some public contribution. We expect there to be public contribution, let's put it that way. We'll see what people come back with.
So that's what I'm asking for, recognizing that we don't know the details yet, but mm-hmm. is what's going to come out as a contract that is something like a public-private partnership with a developer who's going to undergo the actual physical work of contracting it, but with city involvement? I'm just trying to functionally understand how this is going to work, or
yes.
how it might work.
Yeah, that's absolutely the idea, is that this would be a public-private partnership that we'd be stacking hands with that developer, with those architects, with Kimball Art Center. We're working with them on their space at the site, and really all collaborating on coming up with a fantastic community solution.
So in an ideal world, which is one we never live in, when would we see that RFP hit the street, and when would there be an agreement with a developer?
I think the timeline right now is to try to get that RFP out September-ish. I believe, and then we should get responses back by the end of the year and make a selection.
And I know you're pretty deeply involved in this. Are there models that you look at in other cities that strike you as something we should aspire to?
I don't know if there's a template per se. There's definitely examples, right? Mm-hmm. As part of this process, there were some field trips where people went and visited other cities that have done community development type activities. You know, again, these community gathering spaces that bring together different things that people are looking for and want to be there, right? That's the key here. We want a place that's connected throughout town, not just by cars. In fact, deprioritizing cars, right? Connected by transit, by trails, being able to walk around there and really looking at the whole area too. So that's why we're not just talking about those 5 acres on the corner of Bonanza and Kearns. We're talking about that Bonanza Park area. And that's that area planning exercise where the Planning Commission is now considering some zoning changes or new zoning, I guess I could say, that would apply to the entire Bonanza Park area.
And do you have a sense of how much potential employer low-income housing would be part of this project yet?
We don't really have any numbers. Yeah. We did give some pretty aggressive goals to the consultants we've been working with who are writing this RFP that brings us back that developer. So again, we'll just have to see what their models look like. One of the guiding principles we talked about is that we would like no more than, I think it was 20% of the housing to be market rate, so that 80% of the housing built at that site would qualify as affordable, which is a pretty wide range here, right? That can go down pretty deep, and it can go up to, I think, the mid-100s a year for a family of four.
And while we're on Bonanza Park, well, first of all, anything else to touch on with the 5-acre parcel?
Well, that's a pretty good summary of where we're at.
Yeah. The other thing I know that happened, I think last night, involved the burying of power lines.
Yes.
Okay, why is that important, and why does the city have to pay for it?
It's quite an exciting project. Not everyone gets excited about power lines.
Spoken like a consultant, Jeremy.
That's right. You know, it is what it is. So what we're talking about there are the lines that bring power into town, essentially, run down 224. And they're those lines you see that go up Boot Hill and over the cemetery. They come over that corner of Bonanza and Kearns, the 5 acres we're talking about, and then into that substation that's back there by the recycle center. So that whole stretch from Boot Hill to that substation is going to go underground. So not only is that going to be a really nice entry corridor, right, but there's also a lot of practical improvements. There's wildfire mitigation. There's freeing up the potential to use land on that 5-acre parcel where those big power lines are running through. We're going to be freeing up burial plots in the cemetery. There's other benefits around the way that the power network works, and we're doing it in a modular way where if we do need to increase capacity in the future, or if Rocky Mountain Power needs to, or if we can ever have the conversation about actually moving that substation, that it can move along that new buried line. So this is a step towards a final solution if it goes that way. If it doesn't, the lines are still buried and it's still an improvement all around.
And how long will it take to complete that project? I imagine it's going to take a while.
Well, the longest part is getting the parts, and that's about a year out. Mm-hmm. So we basically authorized last night to move forward with Rocky Mountain Power. They've been amazing collaborating with us on many, many iterations of this. I think the city manager last night mentioned this has been going on for 15, 20 years, talking about those power lines. So thanks for hanging in there with us. Let's just say that publicly. Now that we're moving forward, we would expect this to begin in 2025 and hopefully get completed pretty quickly.
And one of the things you mentioned was that burying the power lines has some positive implications for other potential developments in the area. Does this really sort of impact the potential Deer Valley affordable housing project as well?
No, it's upstream,
Okay.
I guess you could say, and kind of across the street.
Okay.
I'm not super familiar. It hasn't really come in front of us in detail.
Okay.
But I don't believe it's related.
Okay. And you mentioned that the potential for finally moving that power station. Is that I've heard about that for a long time. How will that decision ever get made?
Just like this one, right?
Slowly.
We'll just keep, we'll keep going at it. We'll keep coming up with solutions, working with our city staff, our engineering teams, and, you know, just keep plugging away.
I know that there was a brief discussion last night about the Main Street area plan,
mm-hmm.
And there's a committee that's dealing with that. What can you tell us about that process, where it is and where it's likely to go?
Yes, we have a couple liaisons. Nan and Ryan are working on that. They'd be way more in the details, but at a high-level summary that the council received, and there's a report updating it in our packet from last night that's out there publicly, sounds like they're having some really great conversations. That's another project that is moving forward quickly. Some really groundbreaking ideas out there and some new stuff to consider. We're excited to learn more as it pushes forward here.
Again, how does something like that work? Most of the land is privately held. How can the city sort of bring about change? Do you do zoning changes? How would it work?
Yeah, there's a lot. So zoning is definitely a way, right? Mm-hmm. Land use regulation and what applies to what can be done and what can be done in certain spaces, that definitely matters. There's also a lot of city land in question, right? In the Main Street area here, as we look out the window, right? We can probably identify we have parking lots, we have streets, we have sidewalks, we have pocket parks. There's a lot of pieces to move around the board here.
One of the things I believe are in the paper was this concept of replacing the post office with a town square. Are you at all familiar with, do you have any information on where that sits in the process?
No, I really don't. It sounds exciting.
Yes.
Looking forward to hearing more about it.
And I think it would be very, it struck me as it might be complicated to get the post office to agree to do anything, but that's a different problem. There was a discussion about a change in the water impact fee. Can you explain what that is and, what challenges it presents?
Sure, yeah, and I'll try not to get too wonky on this one because it goes back to that infrastructure stuff I just love, but yeah. So the impact fee is a fee charged at the highest level, we call it, to new development. And it's important to know, though, that new development doesn't necessarily mean building something new. It could also be a change in use. So really the trigger for this is someone going to the city and getting a building permit. So if you have a space that, used to be an art gallery and it's turning into a restaurant, that would trigger an impact fee, even though the building footprint hasn't changed, perhaps. And so what this is it's a fee assessed that helps pay for the infrastructure that serves the use of that space. Every so often, it makes sense to update the math behind these fees because they reflect the actual capital infrastructure investments that deliver water to these sites. So that's it in a nutshell.
What is the calculation that leads to the need for an increase? And what is the concern about that potential impact on businesses going forward?
Yeah, so the main stuff that goes into, they're the capital investments. In the past 10 years, the biggest capital investment we've had is the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant, which is beautiful. And if people haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out. There's going to be tours, and it's really a state-of-the-art facility.
It is the prettiest water treatment facility I, for one, have ever seen. A nice, pleasant diversion on the golf course, but that's neither here nor there.
It's Park City. Could you imagine if it wasn't, right? So we're very proud of it, and that wasn't in the currently applied fee calculations.
Okay.
So the
yes.
new fees do include that and some other infrastructure investments that have happened, actually a number of them, in the past 10 years, although the dollars are smaller, they do add up. Our concern as a council was we also don't want to discourage small local business type activity because these fees can be pretty hefty. And we've heard from our community that folks are shocked when they see these bills. And we're not the only ones who assess an impact fee. The sewer district has an impact fee. There's other fees for other things when you're starting new businesses or building a house or building a new commercial development. But this is a big piece of it. So what we asked staff to do was go back and say, we understand the need here. We really want to do this side by side with a program or some kind of mitigation measure so that we're not discouraging someone. We don't ever want to hear someone say, I can't start this business that I could start otherwise because you want to charge me a water impact fee up front here. So let's see what we can do. Can they pay it over time? Are there programs we can use to offset it? Is there a larger economic development type program that we want to talk about as a council? We used to have something like that, and we were looking at reworking it more for where we are as a city. So there's a lot of different options here, but we held off on implementing any new fees at the moment.
It's complicated because at the end of the day, you have to recover the capital costs. I mean, there has to be a way to do that. And I guess you might look at different ways of allocating that cost, but it's still got to get, and someone's got to pay it.
That's right, and that was the conversation, was if we don't have fees at all, then they're gonna show up in our water bills,
right?
Essentially. That money has to be generated somehow. So we're trying to get creative and make sure we're not discouraging new activity.
Chairman, and I may not have this quite right, there was some discussion last night that I heard about concerns about the effect that different kinds of ownership can have on the ability of a neighborhood to deal with things like trash cans being left on the street. Can you talk a little bit about that? I didn't quite follow it.
Sure, yeah, we've heard from our community through a number of different iterations, right, that the house next to me is empty most of the year, and, you know, their lawn is blighted, and their noxious weeds are coming into my lawn, right? There's a nightly rental next to me, and it's a party, and they're going all night. We see it in the police blotter in the paper, right? Sometimes we get a chuckle out of some of these things, and sometimes they're relatively serious, and they're chronic issues. So what we're really asking for is the city does have a number of mechanisms where if a neighbor or neighborhood feels that there's a property that's causing a nuisance, there are avenues they could follow. We have a lot of codes. We have a lot of ways to regulate that. And really, you know, we don't want to over-regulate anything, but we do want to make sure that folks are able to enjoy their property and that they enjoy living here in Park City and they don't feel like they're getting pushed out of their neighborhood, especially from commercial-type activities. So we basically asked staff to summarize what we have out there and how folks could interact with the city if they do experience issues. And if in that process we look at some of the complaints that have come in and we have any gaps in our current policies and codes, we could have a discussion around filling those gaps. But we wouldn't know what those are or if there are even any until we see that analysis.
And it's been a while since I've got to ask about this. What's going on with the pickleball project?
Well, we heard from Ed last night that he's been working, he's a liaison with our recreation group there, and that there's a potential public-private partnership that's spinning up here. There's been a RFP, I believe, out on the street, or an RFQ, some type of procurement vehicle to gather interest. Sounds like there's some traction, so that's another one we're excited to hear more about.
Okay, Jeremy, anything else we should touch on before we go?
You know, I think that that pretty much covers it. I will just give a quick shout out here to our city staff. You know, we were on break for a bit and we came back and we got a report about all these projects in flight. We have a lot of transit stuff going on that's in this report. You know, just a lot of really great activity. Everyone's working really hard and we're still generating record revenues from our taxes in town without having the impact that we're hearing a few years ago that people felt was really burdening us. So all around, really great stuff, and just a big thank you out there.
Okay, we've been speaking with Jeremy Rebell from the Park City Council. Jeremy, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yep, thank you. Have a good day.
In the studio with me now is Sarah Irvin, KPCW's Development Director. Sarah, tell us about the Back Alley Bash.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. And yes, the Back Alley Bash is tonight. This is a longtime locals' favorite event. Thank you to Cole Sport for being our title sponsor of this event I think it's been 3 decades now. And it is back in City Park again this year. We are so excited to be able to take full advantage of the City Park stage there and have live music from local bands Bad Francis starting at 5 p.m. and Mud Puddle at 7 p.m. It's a free event open to the whole community. We hope everyone comes out and bring your own picnic. We're not selling food on site, so we do want people to know it's bring your own picnic, BYOB, bring your picnic blankets, chairs. There'll be kids activities, face painting, balloon twisting, and just a great old time with live music under the beautiful summer sky.
And traditionally, this has been held right before we start the pledge drive, hasn't it?
I think it's been held, yes. For the last several years, it's been right before we start the pledge drive. I hear that years ago, it was at the end of the pledge drive. It's a way of our station being able to say thank you so much to the community for showing your support to KPCW during our pledge drive. And we are already in our count window for our summer fundraising efforts. Donations are coming in, and we're so grateful to those that have donated online. We are going to be on air with active fundraising starting first thing Monday morning at 8 a.m. and continuing through Thursday of next week. We've got a whole slew of folks queued up to join us in studio.
And there are some unusual things about our pledge drive that I think make it different than some of the other pledge drives you see around the country. The first is sort of the participation that we have with various local nonprofits. Can you explain how that works, Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, it's interesting the way that we do it because we really don't want to just have everyone tune out during a pledge week, which is what happens in a lot of other public radio markets. You hear the host asking for money and people turn it right off. In our case, what we do is we invite dozens of partners from around the community in the nonprofit space and business space who serve as sponsors throughout the week. And they come on air to talk about the relationship that they have with KPCW and the value that KPCW provides to their organizations throughout the year. We have nonprofit partners who come on as regular guests on the local news hour every month. They are featured in news stories all year long. They use our community calendar, which is a free service that we offer to any nonprofit based in or operating and serving in Summit and Wasatch counties. It's a way for them to post information about their upcoming events or volunteer needs, fundraisers, and our DJs read from that. When you hear our DJs at the quarter after the hour and 45 minutes after the hour reading public service announcements, that's what they're reading from. Those are free to the nonprofits to post. They get free airtime for that. And finally, during the pledge drive, they have the opportunity to earn free underwriting credit. So it's. I want to make it very clear to folks, when you donate to KPCW during the pledge drive, those donations are coming to the radio station. And we can get into sort of why we do this fundraising and what it costs to operate the station. So when you donate to KPCW, you are donating to the station. You are not donating to the nonprofit in studio. But what you're doing is you're helping them earn free underwriting credit and save them marketing money down the road so that they can come in and record underwriting spots. And they have that little bank of credit earned for helping us fundraise during our pledge drive.
You know, another thing about our pledge drive that is a little bit unusual is the quality of the premiums that we're able to supply.
We do. When you give to KPCW, you can get fantastic items in return. Big thanks to local businesses around town that contribute gifts that we're able to offer to our donors. Bill White Restaurants, Shabu, Big Dipper, just up the street on Main Street, just donated gift cards for the first time to us. There's so many to name. They're on our website. If you're interested in what gifts you can get, we encourage you to check out kpcw.org and click on that pledge drive banner to see the full list of businesses that have contributed gifts to our fundraising efforts. We'll have ski season lift tickets from Deer Valley, activity packages, all kinds of great restaurants and local businesses that you can go frequent thanks to your donation to KPCW.
And we encourage you to look at that and donate early, particularly during the 9 a.m. Mountain Money Hour on Monday, because some of the best premiums do disappear before too many days go by during the week.
It's true. You might want to donate before Thursday. I'll give you that. And people can hop online now and start donating. If you want to donate in honor of a specific hour of the pledge drive, we certainly need you to mention that in the comments with your online donation so that we know which hour to attribute your generosity to. If you don't mention an hour, we're going to go ahead and thank you right there in the 8 a.m. Monday morning news hour when the news team is in studio to kick things off. And we love giving our donors shout outs on the radio. So we'd love to read any messages that you want to share with the news team or with any other of the organizations that are going to be joining us throughout the week of the pledge drive. We'll make sure those messages do get read on air. And we want to thank you for, you know, giving now and giving often.
With about a little over a minute left, Sarah, can you just talk a little bit about why we have to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. So it costs about $2.5 million to run this station. That is tremendous growth for this public radio station. In the time that I've been here, that number has gone up by about $200,000 every year. So our fundraising efforts need to expand every year. And about $1.5 million of that $2.5 million, more than half our operating budget, is salaries and benefits for our people. Another $400,000, I should say, in benefits. This station could not operate without the people that work here. We have about 30 or so people on our payroll, 19 full-time, news team, production, development, finance, admin, and then, of course, all of our fabulous public affairs hosts, our weekend DJs. We've got just a really incredible team of people here, and the station wouldn't be what it is without them. So that is a huge part of why we fundraise. We also have other programming costs. NPR is not free to us. APM Marketplace is not free to us. Engineering costs, music, AP. So all of this is incredibly important to the station, and we have to fundraise for it. We raise about a quarter of our budget in each pledge cycle. So next week, we're hoping to raise about $350,000 throughout the course of the week.
It's a good target. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Roger.